Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. On the Valley freeways, a collision I-17 northbound at Northern has the shoulder blocked, and in the East Valley, an accident on the 60 eastbound at Greenfield. Valley weather for the rest of today, we should stay partly cloudy to mostly sunny, with highs in the lower 70s. For tonight, partly cloudy with lows in the mid to upper 40s, and then sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 72. Currently, relative humidity is at 28%, and it's 70 degrees. The governing body of Arizona's public university system voted today to send a letter to President-elect Donald Trump urging him to help protect students who were brought to the country illegally as children, known as Dreamers. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, a Trump presidency has put these students' future in limbo.
The Arizona Board of Regents is asking President-elect Trump to work with Congress to provide an accommodation for these students within his overall approach to immigration. Regent Jay Hyler says he's optimistic Trump will heed the letter after hearing the president-elect say in an interview he wanted to, quote, work something out for these students. Hyler says the regents are not trying to box in Trump politically.
On the contrary, we're simply sharing our thoughts with him about an issue that we've had the benefit of studying and analyzing and viewing in the light of real individuals who we know and care about for the past several years.
But Karina Uribe urges the regents to be careful with how they frame this issue. Flanked by fellow Dreamers, she interrupted the meeting for about 2 minutes to read a statement criticizing the language in the regents' letter. Often, she says, when people praise Dreamers like her,
what they do is build a good immigrant, bad immigrant dichotomy, which we want to break. Because going into this new presidency, we see that there's going to be a lot of attacks on people who are quote-unquote criminals. And we don't want to further criminalize our communities, our families, our parents.
Trump has called for a repeal of all President Obama's actions on immigration, which would include 2012's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, the action that gives temporary status to young people brought into the U.S. illegally as children. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The uncertainty over the president-elect's potential decisions on immigration-related executive actions has put DACA recipients in a scary position, and many people who wouldn't be affected are thinking back to their own experiences as young immigrants. When Daniel Rodriguez was 7 years old, his mother brought him from Mexico to Arizona. They were fleeing violence in their hometown, and it wasn't until he was in high school that he found out he was undocumented.
And I focused a lot on education after that, because for me, education was the only way out and the only way that I can get ahead.
Rodriguez received more than 15 different scholarships to pay for his education at Arizona State University. But in 2006, his junior year, Proposition 300 passed in Arizona, and all of a sudden, his tuition went way up. He was no longer allowed to get public scholarships or in-state tuition for school.
I just remember getting a call from the financial aid department saying you no longer qualify and now you have to pay three times as much out of pocket. For me and for a lot of students that were impacted by Proposition 300, this was devastating.
He raised the money it took to finish college and part of law school, but he couldn't afford to finish his law degree until President Obama issued an executive order called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, in 2012. DACA meant that Rodriguez and many other Dreamers, young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children, were able to come out of the shadows. Rodriguez was issued a Social Security number and was able to work to pay for college. But President-elect Donald Trump has said he would do away with the DACA program. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with Daniel Rodriguez about some of this, and she's here now. Lauren, what does he say about the election and reaction among Dreamers?
Rodriguez says people are really afraid. This was an executive action by President Obama, so President Trump could just as easily take it away. Rodriguez is now an immigration attorney in the Valley, and he says to understand how devastating it would be for them to take DACA away, you have to understand how much DACA has meant to the nearly 50,000 students in Arizona who have benefited from it.
DACA was the first time that I had an official government-issued ID. When you grow up thinking that you're American, that you're like everyone else, but you're missing some of these things, it really ostracizes you and makes you think that you're different and that you don't belong in the only country which you've called home. And so I remember when I received my DACA and to have that ID with my name saying that I can be here, that I exist, it was very emotional for me.
So what would it mean to lose it?
I remember in 2006 when Proposition 300 was passed. I was definitely devastated, but again, I was fortunate enough to be in a situation where I could continue my studies. Harder, but I could continue. Getting calls from friends, crying, saying that they were not going to go back to school. Waiting into the next semester and seeing empty seats in classes. I've had friends that I had to go to their house just to be able to get them out of bed because everything that they had hoped for, the dreams, they were just dashed when Proposition 300 was passed. We grew up in a country that told us, you work hard, you go to school, and you're going to make it. And to close that door on us was heartbreaking. We took a long time to get the spirits of dreamers, of these immigrant youth, back up and to say, let's keep working, let's keep working, let's not give up on this. DACA was a huge blessing because at least here in Arizona, you get three things with DACA. You get protection from deportation. You're able to get your ID and apply for some of these basic benefits that other individuals get. And three, now you're able to pay in-state tuition at the Maricopa Community Colleges and at the three main universities. Now you're able to do that and work. So you're able to go back and finish something that you may have started recently or you may have started like me years ago. So now to be in a situation where that could potentially be taken away from us again, it's another punch in the gut. It's another fear that I have that more students are going to be lost, more students are going to lose hope, and it's going to be harder to get them engaged in the future.
It's interesting because I think often when you talk about DACA and about dreamers, it's a conversation about the economy or about education, sort of these practical things. But the way you're talking about it, it sounds like it's really about identity for you.
Dreamers as a movement has always been about identity. It has always been about people like me that were brought here when we were young, that grew up with you, that made friends with you, that went to school, to church, took the bus with you. But there was always something that made us different, and that was the lack of a 9-digit number. And it's always been about that. It's been about the opportunity to work. It's been about the ability to go to school. But I think that more than anything, it's been about the fight to have America accept us as their children. And for many of us, that's been what has hurt the most. Dreamers are resilient. Immigrant families are resilient. But the bigger fight is really how do we become full with the only country that we've ever known.
So as a lawyer, you said you're getting these calls now. What can you tell people?
There's nothing that I can tell them about what they can do about things that could happen because I don't know what's going to happen. We know that President-elect Trump has voiced his support to revoke the DACA program. How that's going to happen, when that's going to happen, the details are unsure, but people definitely have the questions now. The best thing that I can tell individuals and the advice that I give them is if you have DACA already, renew it. If you're going to school, take advantage of it. Come up with a plan so that if it is revoked, you and your family are going to be ready.
Rodriguez also told me, among all of this fear, he's felt heartened by the number of people who have come forward to speak in support of Dreamers and DACA students.
And as we mentioned earlier in the show, the Arizona Board of Regents announced this morning they'll send a letter to President-elect Donald Trump and his administration, restating their dedication to giving DACA students as much support as possible, including keeping their state at an in-state level, tuition rather, at an in-state level. But Lauren, this is the second letter of this type. The Board of Regents themselves received a letter very much like this one that got all of this started, right?
Right. An ASU English professor wrote a letter addressed to the administrators of all of Arizona's public universities and community colleges calling for their support of DACA students. Now, more than 1,200 faculty, staff, and students have signed the letter to show their support.
And what does the letter call for exactly?
So it outlines several things: that students' privacy rights remain a guarantee, that they continue in-state tuition. It calls for confidential student counseling for DACA students. And they say they should put measures in place to ensure that these students can complete their degrees if they are deported. So I spoke with the professor who wrote this letter. His name is Joe Lockard. He actually taught Daniel Rodriguez when he was a student at ASU. And I asked him why he thinks it's important for administrators and professors to take the lead on something like this. And here's what he had to say.
We're the ones responsible for making sure that Arizona's students get educated. And if we don't speak up, who will?
I want to talk a little bit about Daniel and students like him that you've taught over the years. How did they affect you, and did they help you realize that this was an issue?
I asked Daniel Rodriguez to come into class one day after he graduated. He was then in law school, to speak about DACA students and dreamers. And after his talk, which was very persuasive, one of my students, who was a Air Force officer, came up to me after class and said, "Professor Lockard, I normally would not agree, but after listening to Daniel speak, I had a very different perspective, and I'm much more sympathetic." I think that the conversations that occur quietly, where we listen to people's stories, become profoundly affecting. That's what Daniel Rodriguez can contribute, and others like him, if we stop, sit, and listen, rather than fall back on catchphrases and instant reaction politics, that we begin to understand. And particularly, we begin to understand why education is so vital, because that not only lifts up the student, but it lifts us up as a society.
Were students like Daniel in your mind when you were drafting this letter?
Of course. There are tens of thousands of such students, and I come as a teacher. I get upset when there's the prospect that they'll be taking away students. These are students who've grown up here.
I wonder, just are you surprised that you're the voice coming forward to talk about this as an English teacher? Like, what kind of things do you normally teach?
I teach American literature.
Right. So why is it important for you, coming from where you come from, to be a voice on this?
One of the things one sees in reading American literature are ever-present themes. Themes of immigration, migration, or themes of family separation. When I see pictures of, for example, an ASU student who goes to meet her mother by the border wall, and they hold hands through the wall, my heart cries. But we find these same themes in American literature. Uncle Tom's Cabin is all about family separation. In reading literature, we read human stories such as The Dreamers.
And you hope that message can carry forth here?
One always hopes. One is at times cynical, skeptical. But in the end, if we don't get up in the morning with hope, what are we doing?
That was ASU Professor Joe Lockard, who wrote the letter calling on Arizona's universities and community colleges to support DACA students if President-elect Donald Trump revokes the program.
This show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
An unwelcome spotlight has been shining on the University of Arizona's pair of medical schools through much of 2016. It's been related to financial concerns and leadership. And on Thursday, Dr. Joe Garcia, who's been in charge of health sciences at U of A, announced he was stepping down from that post. To get more details, I'm joined by AZPM reporter Vanessa Barchfield. Vanessa, give us some background on Joe Garcia. When he started with the school, what has happened since? There's been some controversy around him.
Right. Yeah. So Joe Garcia, who actually goes by Skip, was hired as senior vice president of the University of Arizona Health Sciences in 2013. And for the first few years, you know, sort of business as usual. The trouble really started earlier this year when the long-term dean of the University of Arizona's Phoenix Medical School, Dr. Stuart Flynn, resigned to join a new medical school in Fort Worth, Texas. And he took along about half a dozen senior leaders with him. That prompted the Arizona Medical Association to call on the Arizona Board of Regents, which of course governs the universities, to investigate why all of that senior leadership left. And it was kind of a vote of no confidence in the U of A leadership at that point.
So Joe Garcia, Skip Garcia, is going to remain with the school and full salary as well, right? So what's been the reaction to his resignation from that post? Has the Board of Regents said anything about that?
Yes. Yeah, so that just happened yesterday. The Board of Regents and the University of Arizona administration is heaping praise on him. And he's saying that he decided to leave to, you know, return to his true loves, which are teaching and research. But of course, there are still some questions hanging over. After the Arizona Medical Association called for that investigation in August, the Arizona Board of Regents Health Affairs Committee did respond to their questions, and they held two public hearings on health services to get input from the community. The first meeting was pretty standard and, relatively boring. The second meeting started with the Arizona Board of Regents President Eileen Klein saying this.
Information has been brought forward that raises questions for us about the ethics of our leaders, the use of public monies, the accuracy of information documented in public records, and the workplace culture and treatment of employees.
That statement clearly frazzled Skip Garcia and U of A President Ann Weaver Hart, and eventually, Ann Weaver Hart called on the Board of Regents to investigate those allegations that she made.
So considering what you said about Dr. Flynn and the number of people that left with him from the U of A Medical School in Phoenix, and now we have this decision by Skip Garcia, what are people saying about the short-term future of U of A Medical School? Are there concerns being expressed? Are people feeling like, well, no, this is good, we'll have a breath of fresh air? What are they telling you, or what are they saying?
I think it's pretty much too early to say. I mean, there's still so many questions lingering. So the U of A and the Board of Regents actually did hire a law firm to look into the full health of the medical schools and health sciences. That review was conducted over 2 months and finalized in October. And no one knows what's in the report. It hasn't been made public. The Arizona Board of Regents are citing attorney-client privilege and keeping it secret. So really, we don't really know.
So Vanessa, beyond what we've spoken about, so now that we know Skip Garcia is not in that position anymore, where do we go from here?
So the U of A will name an interim dean soon. They haven't said exactly when, and there's also no indication who that may be.
Vanessa Bartsfield, reporter for Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Vanessa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The emotional battle over the David and Gladys Wright House in Phoenix's Arcadia area has continued for several years. Many neighbors wanted the house to be preserved, but didn't like the idea of it becoming a place for special events and more. But earlier this week, a city council meeting may have marked the end of one chapter. The Frank Lloyd Wright designed home will not be designated a historic landmark. Thomas Galvin of the Rose Law Group represents one of the property's neighbors.
We consider this as a win for the Arcadia neighbors who opposed the commercialization of Arcadia. We would like to see this house remain in a residential use.
The future for the home site may include partnerships with a university or a philanthropic group. The fight over the Wright House has illustrated the emotions that are tied to the preservation over a residential property. But how different is residential preservation from commercial? Jim McPherson is a consultant and preservation advocate. Jim, Phoenix has designated 35 neighborhoods as historic, but what about commercial preservation? How does the city look in that sense?
So on the commercial side of things, we're in the kind of the Wild West, and zoning is or any type of private property controls are difficult. So it's pretty freewheeling, and has been for generations. So there has been a need for new buildings. I mean, you can't have adobe structures as two-story brick structures when you're becoming a major metropolis. Along the way, many buildings have gone down. Over time, we've had some successes in restoring and renovating historic buildings on the commercial side. The warehouse district is now coming back.
Is there any less emotion attached to preservation of a commercial building as opposed to someone's home where someone lived? Have you noticed there's any more or less emotion attached to one or the other?
I think there's more emotion attached to one's home. That's where you live and your neighbors surround you. And so we do have, as I mentioned, 35 designated historic neighborhoods. And then you have strong neighborhood associations that work to protect the character of those neighborhoods. And what that means is, maintain the exterior, the way it looks, the look and feel, so much so that the tax credit continues. Because if you do too much renovation, for example, take out windows that are not in keeping with the character of the original windows, then that could damage the, you know, the historic integrity of the house, maybe lose your chance to continue with the tax credit, and enough houses where that happens, then possibly the district is harmed. And you've seen this resurgence of historic home tours, where people just flock to see what their neighbors and folks across the city have done in these neighborhoods, and they're very successful events, and really help to show the different time periods of our city with commercial structures. I mean, for example, you see the loss of the old opera house or the old Fox Theater, and you're just going, how on earth could these wonderful structures have been demolished for, let's say, a bus station or something, some other use, or just to lay fallow as an empty lot. It's difficult from a preservation standpoint to see these things happen. So you're always looking for, you know, partners and opportunities to reuse these buildings.
Have you noticed that if there is a particular name attached, obviously Frank Lloyd Wright is a big name, if there's a name attached, if there's a particular designer of a particular home, or if someone had some sort of ties to a commercial building, how much more heft does that carry?
To become eligible or to become designated as a historic property is a pretty rigorous process. You just don't throw the word out historic willy-nilly. So it could be a historic event happened at a place. It could be a very important person was associated with the building. The architectural style or the makeup of the building or site. Those are criteria that are researched and evaluated. So when you have someone like Frank Lloyd Wright associated with a building that's pretty cut and dried, that at least scores points in the designation favor.
Jim McPherson is a consultant and preservation advocate in Phoenix. It's a week of economic forecasting in Arizona. On Monday, Lee McFeeters of ASU's W.P. Carey School said that 2017 should be a year of job growth for Arizona, with the state's unemployment rate dropping below 5%. He also said he'll be watching what effect a higher minimum wage has on Arizona's economy. Today in southern Arizona, the Eller School at the U of A held its Economic Outlook Luncheon. And with me to talk about Tucson's economy in 2017 is George Hammond, director of the school's Economic and Business Research Center. George, let me start off with what a lot of people tend to be very focused on, which is job growth. What are you looking forward to in Tucson as far as 2017 goes? And are there elements you're looking at 2017 that are clearly better trends than there have been for the past couple of years in Tucson?
Well, Tucson is already growing quite a bit faster this year than it was last year. In fact, our growth rate so far this year is roughly double what we saw at this period last year. So Tucson's already picking up momentum. I think there's a really good chance that we're going to carry that momentum into 2017 and 2018. Part of that is driven by the fact that the slow growth we've seen from 2013 to 2015 was driven by federal fiscal drag related to the sequester and other budget cuts. That's over. And in fact, it seems like we may be poised to see a bit of an increase in federal government spending with the new administration. That winds up being defense spending or even spending on border security that could, you know, boost what I think we'll see in Tucson, even above the baseline forecast. So overall, you know, Tucson's well positioned. We've had some major announcements with Raytheon and Vector Space Systems announcing major job increases over the next couple of years. So, you know, Tucson's well positioned to carry the strength that we see in 2016 into 2017 and 2018.
There are obviously a lot of talk related to the incoming Trump administration and some of the comments that have been made about Mexico. Certainly Arizona's relationship with Mexico is important. I would think Tucson's is as well. How much could Tucson be affected economically based on relations between the U.S. and Mexico going forward?
Well, one area where we're already seeing an impact, I think, is on the value of the U.S. dollar versus the peso. The dollar from roughly the middle of 2014 to October of 2016, the dollar was already up 45% versus the peso. And after the results of the election, the dollar rose even further to all-time highs. And we're, you know, based on that dollar appreciation, we're already seeing impacts, I think, on our merchandise exports, which are down about 10% to Mexico over the year. And we're also seeing, you know, significant slowdowns, I think, in people crossing the border from Mexico to Arizona. to shop in Arizona. So there are some pretty significant impacts. I think they get bigger the closer we get to the border. It will be something that we'll have to keep an eye on going forward.
So as you're looking ahead to next year, maybe even 2018 as well, what does the housing market look like in Tucson? And how has the recovery been there compared to the rest of the state?
Well, in Tucson, the recovery has been slow, just as it has been for Arizona and Phoenix, probably a bit slower in Tucson than for the rest of the state, just because Tucson has been growing slower in terms of job and population than has Phoenix or the state on average. Overall, so far this year, housing permit activity is up, but most of that strength in Tucson was really concentrated in the early months of the year. Since then, we've seen a pretty significant slowdown. I think as population growth accelerates, Tucson's housing market will gain a little bit of momentum. But even then, we're not heading back to the kind of boom years that we saw just before the Great Recession.
The Eller School at the University of Arizona held its Economic Outlook Luncheon today. And we just talked about that and what to look ahead for in 2017 with George Hammond, director of the Eller School's Economic and Business Research Center. George, thank you for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Steve. Enjoyed it.
Lucid Motors last week became one of the latest companies to announce plans to invest in the state and add jobs, 2,000 in the carmaker's case. That decision includes $5 million from the Arizona Commerce Authority. The company could ultimately claim more than $40 million if it creates all 2,000 jobs it's promised. Many of these announcements and the expansions into Arizona also come with some kind of incentives from the state or cities. And today, the Phoenix Business Journal takes a look at how many of the jobs companies promise when they move here actually materialize. Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the paper and wrote the piece. And Eric, first off, let's define our terms and the difference between committed and actual jobs.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about it. When a company comes to town and they want to get an incentive from the state or local government, they enter into a contract. And as part of that contract, they say, over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to hire X number of people. We're going to pay an average of this wage, and we're going to invest this much in capital. And that's the commitment. So Arizona Commerce Authority, cities, they budget how much the incentive is based on that commitment. One of the things Arizona does that a lot of states don't is Arizona doesn't pay out a penny until a company achieves those milestones.
So based on your research, for the companies that are coming in and saying, we're going to hire this number of people, we're going to invest this much, their wages for these employees are going to be this much, are those companies following through on those commitments?
Actually, for the most part, they're doing more. I mean, we've had some spectacular flameouts, the SunTech and Goodyear, Zenefits, but you've got companies like ZipRecruiter who said, we're going to hire 138 people over 3 years. They're at 137 people as of the end of August, and they're hiring 30 people a month. So they're well ahead of their commitment. General Motors said, we're going to do 1,000 people over 5 years, and they're at like 600 after one.
I want to ask you about the actual incentives that these companies get either from the Commerce Authority or from the cities or towns or counties. Are they on par with what other government entities in other states are offering? Are we offering more? Are we offering less?
Generally, we're offering less. Arizona's approach is really interesting. The incentives are used as an equalizer. We're not the cheapest state for doing business. So what happens is the incentive is put on the table to equalize our cost against markets that we're competing with. And that takes money out of the equation for deciding where a company should locate. Then the company is starting to look at the qualitative data, the workforce, the quality of life, and the important things, what makes the company successful beyond money. And that's been our great success and what's closed the big deals in the pipeline and some other stuff that's coming down the pipeline. And Lucid is a great example. Nevada gave Tesla $1.2 billion for a $5 billion investment. That's like almost 20%. Lucid is getting between 40 and 50 million when you total up all their incentives on a $700 million investment. That's really under 10%. So, you know, there's a comparison on similar industries.
Have you found that the
type and maybe the amount of the incentive is based on the company. You mentioned Tesla, for example. Tesla is an established company. You can see Teslas driving on the road here and in a lot of other places. Lucid, as it turns out, doesn't have the money yet to make the total investment in the plant that it's looking to make. So it's obviously a less established company. Do you find that the amount of the incentives is based on whether or not you have a company like Tesla or a company like Lucid?
No, that's one of the reasons Arizona didn't go after Tesla. Tesla wanted more money because they were Tesla. But whether or not Nevada gets the return on investment is yet to be seen. With Lucid, the money equalizes what the markets we're competing with, like Sacramento. And with the Arizona system, it's paid out when they reach their milestones. So if they never break ground, and if that plant doesn't happen, we're not out any taxpayer money.
Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the Phoenix Business Journal. Eric, thanks.
Thanks very much.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. Let's go to Seoul, South Korea now, where earlier today the parliament voted overwhelmingly to impeach President Park Geun-hye. It's all a response to a corruption scandal that has enraged that nation and has frozen President Park's ability to lead. The Constitutional Court now has to consider whether to remove her from office. That's a process that could take up to 6 months. President Park has not indicated at this time that she would be willing to go on her own and resign.
Suki Kim is contributing editor for The New Republic and author of Without You, There Is No Us. Suki Kim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, hi.
So what's next in the process here, and is she likely to be removed?
Because the margin was so high, I mean, it was 234 for the impeachment against 56. You need 200 votes. So that's 34 votes over the limit. With that, and also, you know, another part about that is the people's reaction. You know, last weekend, there were 2.3 million people on the streets of Seoul protesting against President Park. So at this point, she can't come back. It takes about 6 months, but they think with this wide margin, they, you know, the court will decide quickly. And once that decision happens, and if she were to even step out before that, then a new election has to happen immediately after that.
So is she likely to go on her own before that? As I said before, she hasn't said she would resign now. A couple of weeks ago when the pressure was on, she suggested that she might be willing to step down on her own. It seems a little at odds.
You know, that speech actually is kind of was the fuel to the fire, because somehow it was immediately reported around the world as if she said she was resigning. She did say that, but she played this really manipulative card where if you translate verbatim, it sounded like she was going to resign. But what she said back then was that she is willing to resign according to the will of the parliament. The parliament only has one thing they can do, which is an impeach the president, which was already being brought up. So all she could do, according to the will of the parliament, is to be fired from her job. But she put it in this way, willing to resign business. And that really angered people, because she still was not saying that she was at fault for anything. In that speech also, she made sure to say she was not guilty for anything herself. She was only guilty for people around her mismanaging them. That's putting blame on everyone else. So that speech, which somehow looked apologetic, if you translate it, was actually the most offensive speech she could have given to the people.
And so now there's just a great deal of uncertainty in Seoul, isn't there? Not only the impeachment of South Korea's own president, but South Korea diplomatically has been extremely nervous about political transitions in the United States. Donald Trump's comments about South Korea and Japan and their alliance in nuclear weapons in the region and China, it's got a lot of South Koreans on edge. It's just coming at them from all angles here.
You know, oddly enough, the one really would be laughing at this and celebrating is North Korea. Because traditionally, the left, which will now take over in South Korea, has been pro-North Korea. And North Korea all along preferred Trump as a candidate. So, you know, they are sort of a double win for North Korea right now.
Suki Kim, contributing editor at The New Republic. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
There's been an increased awareness of concussions and their impacts over the past several years, and sports leagues have worked to adapt. But how parents and young athletes deal with those risks has become somewhat of a debate. Sports journalist Joanne Gerstner is co-author of a new book called Back in the Game. She joins me via Skype. And Joanne, it seems like your approach to the issue of concussions, at least to some degree, goes against the conventional wisdom about preventing and treating concussions. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's decently fair. We've seen a pretty amazing societal evolution. Now, I have to paraphrase that in saying societal evolution here in North America. Other parts of the world, concussion awareness is all over the place. But here in North America, we've gone from 10 years ago, people saying, oh, it's just a bump on the head, rub dirt on it, you'll be fine, to now people actually saying, I'm not going to let my child play any sports at all because I'm very afraid of the consequences. So we're actually advocating a middle path in our book of absolutely be cognizant of concussions, deal with them properly as a serious medical issue, but also don't be afraid of sports because there's a lot of really good societal, social, and physical exercise benefits from children playing in sports.
So in your mind, then, what ideally would that middle ground look like for parents and for student athletes as far as being aware of concussions, being aware of the risks, being aware of treatments if you think you've gotten one, but also not being terrified of playing soccer or playing football or playing lacrosse or playing anything, really?
Well, first of all, the vast majority of people that have concussions heal and lead beautiful, productive lives. So this is not a one-size-fits-all. You get a concussion and the rest of your life is over. So that meme is not true. Second of all, as parents, we need to ask questions. Talk to the coach before you sign up for a team. See what they know about concussions. See what type of coach are they. Are they aggressive? Do they ignore injuries? If you see those things being present and they are pretty obvious, then you have a right not to enroll your child in that sport. Absolutely. On the other hand, also understand your child. What kind of sport kind of fits your child's personality?
What role do you think professional sports and the way that they are handling the issue of concussions plays as far as how parents and coaches and kids handle this issue in their sports?
Well, the challenge we have is that if you're an NFL team or NBA team, you know, you have team doctors, you have athletic trainers on site, on hand. For most of us, when we're on a dusty baseball field with, you know, our 8-year-old child, we don't have those resources. So for parents, we might have to act as the first line of cognizance and action to make sure a child is safeguarded in case something happens. So understanding what to do and how to do it is important. But the other point too is there's still a lot of urban legends that live. Like I've had people tell me, well, if you're not knocked unconscious, you can't have a concussion, right? Well, the vast majority of concussions happen without loss of consciousness. So if we're looking for the wrong things based on what we think we know, we can also get into bad places.
Do you get the sense that there is still a stigma among young people when it comes to concussions? We heard so much, especially in the NFL, about, you know, guys not wanting to come out, wanting to be perceived as tough, being able to play through whatever kind of pain they have. Is that still a thing among young athletes as well?
Oh, it's not only was a thing, it's growing. And you talk about the lessons that we take from watching professional athletes. The younger athletes, say high school, they know now that if you say you're concussed or there is a concussion, they almost see it like a scarlet letter because they know the following is going to happen. They're going to come out of the game. They might not get to play. Someone might take their spot. Their peer pressure of their teammates, they might be letting people down. The clan of I want to be with my teammates and go to practice and not sit out. And then another part of it is, oh my gosh, if I can have a concussion, scary things can happen to me, like suicide or depression. So I don't even want to admit that I have it. So unfortunately, that's kind of the message that's trickling down, that saying you have a concussion or being labeled as having ones could make you damaged goods, which is so not true.
Joanne Gerstner is a sports journalist and teaches sports journalism at Michigan State. She's also the co-author of the book Back in the Game. In Arizona, high school student athletes, as well as those at ASU, have to take an online course about concussions called Brain Book. It's largely the work of Dr. Javier Cardenas, director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. And Javier, I'm curious about what you make of Joanne's perspective that the pendulum has maybe swung too far to the side of caution and not letting kids play sports.
There's no question that the pendulum has swung in the public eye regarding concussions. In the past, even when I played football, I got a pat on the butt and went right back out there, and we know that was wrong. However, even in the medical field, we've seen this swing to the other side. I've seen many patients who come in because their primary care provider or their pediatrician told them after a concussion to go essentially into a cold, dark corner and come out when they're better. This idea that this strict rest or cocoon therapy has really driven a lot of kids away from school, away from activities. And in fact, in those cases, we see a lot of kids that actually have more symptoms and take longer to recover in those instances, where fortunately now science is telling us these things are actually treatable and we can get kids back to their normal activities safely.
Is there a perception out there that if you have a concussion, that basically your life as you knew it is over, that you cannot recover from it, you cannot lead a quote-unquote normal life going forward, and that is sort of driving this desire to keep kids away from them in the first place?
In terms of concussions, what we've seen is this evolution from the acute injury, the injury that happens on the field and the dangers of going back too soon, which is indeed a very real danger, to now what happens long term. And so we do have this concern, even if it's with a single concussion, as to what the rest of their life might be. And this is in large part because of a concern about chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. What we know, however, is that a lot of those symptoms can be treated, things like the headaches, even depression, so we don't get to the point of things like committing suicide.
How do you try to find the balance, especially after a student athlete has had a concussion, between keeping them safe and trying to make sure they don't have more concussions, but also not keeping them in a bubble and letting them get out and blow off steam and have fun playing sports?
Absolutely. So in the clinic, one of the things that we emphasize is indeed getting back to normal activities while being safe. So once that initial period of the concussion, usually it's the first 24 to 72 hours that we see the worst of the symptoms, that indeed is when we want to rest. But then after that, when the kid is starting to feel better, we want to introduce them to normal activities, physical activities, scholastic activities, social activities, all still while keeping them safe from getting another head injury. So in fact, there are studies that show that physical activity, exercise, can be a treatment for concussion if done properly and if done in a gradual fashion, once again, avoiding the risk of another head injury.
Dr. Javier Cardenas is director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute.
Women are moving up the ranks in Arizona's farming operations. These days, more women nationwide are identifying as a primary operator. And as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, that change is making an impact on how the industry does business.
Sunny skies and cool fall temperatures, the perfect combination for farmer Jana Anderson to begin planting a few acres of wheat for a summer harvest.
This is just seed for the wheat that we're growing. This is the white Sonoran.
Anderson is the owner and primary operator of Pinnacle Farms. She grows several types of crops on this 40-acre plot of land just outside of the Phoenix metro area, including heritage varieties of produce. A niche market, but it's a business model that she says gives her an edge.
There's broccoli, a lot of cauliflower in there. And on the other side, there's some of my heritage bean project.
Anderson felt the pull to this line of work when she was in nursing school. She says she was captivated by just how popular a farmer's market near her school was among community members.
And I watched these people knocking down the tents, practically trying to buy produce. And I thought, wow, that is there is a serious market for locally grown produce.
So she jumped in, starting almost microscopically small, with a 20 by 20 foot plot of land. And now she says she couldn't imagine herself doing anything else. And Anderson is one of a growing number of women making the same move.
Well, so far, USDA says that it's the fastest growing demographic.
Julie Murphy, a spokesperson with the Arizona Farm Bureau, adds the number of farms operated by women in the U.S. has almost tripled over the last 30 years, growing to over 15% since the 70s. And women in Arizona are leading the way. Apache and Navajo counties rank first and second nationally for the number of female-run farms. In fact, there are more women than men operating farms in Navajo County. But entering the industry as a woman does carry some unique challenges.
A lot of times they say land and financing can be two of the strongest impediments to entering into that particular ag business.
That's partly because farm operations and the large tracts of land that often come with them have primarily been passed down to the men in farm families.
So one of the ways that women have been able to enter farming is to start small operations.
Rachel Terman is an assistant professor of sociology at Ohio University and co-author of the book The Rise of Women Farmers and Sustainable Agriculture. She says because running a large-scale commercial farm is often out of reach for most women, many are turning to alternative farming methods when jumping into the industry, which means organic and so-called sustainable agriculture are, in turn, seeing an increase. Terman adds, women are also creating informal education networks to help each other navigate the industry.
And so women who have entered farming who may be new and beginning farmers or maybe grew up on a farm but didn't have access to the same types of training that their male counterparts did needed to find different ways of learning about agriculture, learning about how to farm, how to run a business.
Back at Pinnacle Farms, farmer Jana Anderson says in her experience there really is no major drawback in terms of being a woman in agriculture, though she says her husband may sometimes jokingly disagree.
When it comes down to buying things, I'm pretty sure he wishes that I wasn't in farming because a Gucci purse is so much less than some of this equipment.
Luckily, though, no more tractors are on her wish list. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Okay, it's December. We're nearing the end of the year, the home stretch. Some people get a little stressed this time of year, and understandably so. You've got the holidays, families in town. Maybe you want to make some New Year's resolutions or meet the ones you made this year. So just take a deep breath and listen to this next story about calm cats. Yes, cats that have found their happy place with classical music. The show's Annika Klein takes us there.
This is Molly. She lives in a house in Scottsdale with about 60 roommates. Molly mostly hangs out in the bathroom, and her roomies prowl the rest of the digs. This house is actually a shelter called Safe Haven for Animals, and the vibe is very calm.
So we've been having them listen to classical music now for several months.
That's Constance Rossman, one of their humans, also known as a volunteer.
It's calmed the whole scene down so much in here that most of the cats don't even need to be kenneled anymore. They can all just roam about, and they all get along really good.
There are cats in closets, on counters, on top of the fridge, and in every room, there's a radio. A classical music station and also KJZZ's sister station.
Here's the overture from Leonard Bernstein's Candide.
I mean, before we had, like, regular pop, and there was fights, there was hissing.
And now? The low hum of purring provides a metronome for Mozart, Chopin, and Wagner. So if you're stressed out, maybe do what they do. You know, stretch in a sun patch on the floor, get all that energy out by chasing a laser pointer, run on a wheel. And if people get on your nerves, just turn up the Chopin and pretend not to hear them. Okay, you might find it difficult to adapt these tips to your life. Human stress is a little more complex than cat stress.
There's a lot to be said about how we think about our stress.
Sarah Register talks about that topic all day long. She's a stress expert at Directions for Wellness.
what's tricky about being a human being is that we have free will. We have choice.
Beyond the choice between eating kibble or scratching the couch, Register says we get overwhelmed with all these choices and that causes stress. The first thing to do is change our mindset.
Instead of saying, I'm so busy, I'm overwhelmed, you say, you know, the time is now. Or you say, I go with the flow.
Come up with a mantra, your own metronome, to repeat during a busy day. Then at some point, stop. Take time for yourself. And Register says, don't feel guilty doing it.
Because those little comforts are often what people say, oh, I feel guilty when I'm sitting and reading a book. But some of these things are the way that we do find our own mindfulness.
And that gives us more energy to tackle all the other stuff. So indulge a little in a hobby. The cats do. If you're still stressed, a long-term solution might be inviting in a personal stress coach for a nominal fee of love and meow mix. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.